Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Ira Pastor. He is, of course, heading up the company called BioQuark, which is going to be, with regulatory approval, recruiting 20 patients that have no brain function, treating them with stem cells and lasers to try to get them to return to normalcy. What an amazing story. So we'll be back with your calls and Ira in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. We'll get to your calls in a second as well. It's an amazing field, Ira. It truly is. It's limitless, isn't it?
Yeah, at the end of the day, that $7 trillion that's spent on healthcare, when you factor out your infectious diseases, everything filters down to either a disease of cellular degeneration or cellular damage. And at the end of the day, if we can deal with that, those underlying causes of degeneration and damage with an integrated platform, we're going to deal with a lot of the problems responsible for human suffering and death on this planet. So it's potentially transformational.
Do you ever see the time where people are going to get a stem cell vaccine? You just go and get injected. It's almost like a booster shot.
We foresee absolutely that whether it's for disease control purposes or maintenance purposes, because we do obviously lose our stem cell niches and production capability over time as we age, that will definitely be a part of the future, as well as some of these other tools for resetting biologic time in various organs and tissues of our body. So definitely we see this as ultimately translating not just for sort of disease, but for general long-term health and wellness. And we think the potential is fairly unlimited with regard to what that implies for aging or long-term health and so forth.
I think so too. Can you see this not working at all? I can't.
No. This is out of the box now. Regenerative medicine is, it's been a discipline that's been studied technically for decades now. People think of the sort of the stem cell era, which we're in now, but there was a whole era of regenerative biology from sort of the 1930s to the 1970s, where we learned a lot about the dynamics of regeneration and early concepts with in animals with stem cells, and then human stem cells came a little later onto the scene. But we've been studying this area for quite a long time now, and it's now being translated. You don't see big pharma getting involved in it too much because they realize that they have to walk a tightrope between treatment and cure.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, this is unstoppable.
Does big pharma want cures?
I can tell you from the time I've spent there on various sides of the table, it's not that they don't want cures; they don't know how to do it. People, jokingly will always ask, where's the secret warehouse where all the cures are kept? And I tell them, look, the warehouse, well, at least they never took me there, but the warehouse, even if it existed, it will be empty. It's not possible for the current model of the drug industry to create cures. It's not the way they work. The model currently, as it's existed for the last several decades, is basically to develop simple, single, small molecule chemicals against outputs of disease. So things like inflammation and fibrosis and cell proliferation, these are not disease. These are just signs of a dysfunctional organ or tissue. Disease are what precedes those abnormalities. And it's very complex. We have these issues like systems biology nowadays, where we're beginning to understand that disease is caused by many factors, and it's not just this gene doing and developing a drug to block it. That doesn't get us anywhere. It just gets us another treatment. And when you combine that with the way they develop drugs, they look for these molecules that do one thing that can be described simply and have a certain mechanism. It makes no sense, because we all know nowadays, in this late of our century, that multiple biologic processes come together to create these underlying diseases. And then lastly, we develop these gold standard clinical studies that have been in place since the 40s, these double-blind placebo-controlled studies. But we take into account definitions of disease that are decades old. I mean, what do we know now? We know that there's not one form of lung cancer. There could be 300. And it's the same with other chronic degenerative diseases. We know, you know, if there's type 2 diabetes, and we look at patients, and we put them in two groups because their sugar is a certain level. But what we don't understand yet, and this is totally known, we don't understand anything about why, okay? And there could be dozens of different types of type 2 diabetes, dozens of different types of Alzheimer's. Sure. We are just not understanding that. And so ultimately, we can't create cures until we understand how to deal with all of that. And that's why the cures are not here and why we have none.
Some people would say, Ira, we have too many people on this planet now. Why prolong life? Why make people live longer when we can barely pay them out of Social Security today?
Well, from the perspective of population, and, you know, there's a lot of smarter people than me with regard to these dynamics, but I think there's been enough history, at least in 21st century, of some very bad people that tried to control populations of people by controlling the death rate. Okay, you can think of a handful of them off the top of my head. It doesn't work. Population is a function of birth rate, which is a much different issue. And I think, you know, there's been tons of models done on this, and even extending life substantially isn't going to impact the population dramatically in comparison to if we don't do anything about substantial birth rate issues, which is where, you know, that theme should focus. But, you know, I think, you know, ultimately, we're not talking about longer, sicker lives. We're talking about longer, healthier lives. We're talking about somebody that has the ability and isn't humbled and put out of commission at 60 because of multiple degenerative disorders and can't work anymore and can't contribute and can't pay taxes and so forth. We're talking about changing that paradigm entirely. We don't think, you know, the bridge to immortality is around the corner, so I wouldn't worry about that eventuality. But when that happens, I think we are going to be an ingenious enough people to know how to deal with that. Society will change a bit, but I think we'll be able to come up with those answers. They'll be difficult answers, but nonetheless, if we can reverse death and deal with aging, I think we can deal with pretty much.
All right, let's go to the phones. Sharon in Yorba Linda, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Sharon. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you so much. I'm so excited about your show tonight.
Well, great.
I have a son that was diagnosed with schizophrenia at 18, and I'm wondering whether this procedure might be able to, stem cell research procedure might be able to help him.
Well, I mean, schizophrenia is a disorder that is clearly a function of underlying damage in the central nervous system. We believe that the answers to conditions, excuse me, like schizophrenia, like depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, are conditions that technically don't really require a regenerative event, but require a reparative one. And that is what we work on as well. So looking at sort of the schizophrenic brain and how we don't really need to regenerate anything, but how we turn back time, how we take regulatory state B, which is where the disease is, and go back and reset those cells to a point before they were expressing the disease phenotype, we think, yes, I mean, there's going to be, as exciting as regeneration of the central nervous system is, its actual repair and disease reversion of disease states is going to be equally exciting and is something we're actively working in.
Can you see the implications for Alzheimer's disease, too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, I mean, that is clearly with the amount of activity going on in that space and the sort of the flood of Alzheimer's cases that are expected in the coming years and decades, and the government's own numbers with regard to this, it clearly is going to be a target of ours, especially as it is a chronic degenerative disorder of the central nervous system. Now, a lot of the activity that goes on there, one of the things that bothered me about the pharmaceutical space, is everyone just sits around and argues about why. We don't really care why. We don't care if it's beta amyloid. We don't care if it's tau. We don't care if it's some process of inflammation. None of that is really relevant to what we're interested in. We're just interested in turning back the disease phenotype to before the Alzheimer's existed. And when you can control cell state and control reprogramming, we don't worry about what's ultimately the output of the Alzheimer's and why it's happening. We care about the underlying physical state of the cells.
What's happening now with stem cells in people with blindness?
There's been some activity in terms of macular degeneration in recent years. It's going slowly. There's been some, let's say, phase one, two type work going on in the United States with some sort of beneficial outcomes to date. But I'm not aware that those studies have yet moved up to sort of substantially sized and well-powered ones. I mean, the main player in that space was Bob Lanza's group, Okada, which was recently acquired by a Japanese pharmaceutical company. And, I've been through a pharma company M&A in the past.
Oh, sure.
And it's always up in the air whether technology is acquired and developed or acquired and destroyed. But we'll see. We'll see what comes out of that. But I know that was the sort of the most advanced program in that particular area.
Is BioQuark public or private right now?
No. We are currently a private company funded by a set of accredited investors that I've worked with in the past. I have not looked to the public markets as of yet. I've not even looked to institutional private equity for this company. I've been through that in the past. It's not the most exciting path if you want to try to avoid keeping your technology out of the so-called valley of death. So we're pretty comfortable the way things are going so far.
Well, there seems to be a lot of excitement, Ira, about what you do.
And, yeah, I mean, it's...
think it's the future.
It's the Holy Grail. It's the Holy Grail, and it takes a, what we refer to as a combinatorial approach to solving problems of disease. The combination therapies have never been that exciting, but in recent years with HIV cocktails, with combination chemotherapies, we're beginning to realize that you're never going to get it done with a single magic drug bullet. You've got to look at disease as a combination of factors, and you got to deal with them. Regulators don't always like it because they want you to develop, if you want to give somebody 20 different drugs, they want you to develop 20 different drugs and spend $20 billion and then ultimately combine them. But we think there's a lot of benefit in looking at how nature does things in complexity and combination and mimicking them. And so that's why we're very focused on this approach.
Let's go to Tom in Ohio. Welcome to the program, Tom. You're on the air with us.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, George. Good morning. I just wanted to ask your guest, how would he feel about how the electrical impulses would start with the brain? And also I had another question about if the person regained consciousness, what if it's not the person that regains consciousness, but it's another person that has passed on?
And
thank you for letting me
sure.
Ask my question.
Sure, absolutely. Well, let's take the second one first, Ira. And that, again, is that question I asked some time ago about
right. What
happens when they come out of this coma. Mm-hmm. Who might they be?
Well, once again, excellent point. I mean, in terms of the electrical impulses of the brain, and we've created the protocol such that it has two components. It has, as we've talked, the stem cell and the biologic component, so in essence the regeneration and regrowth of neural tissue, but then it has other tools that are typically used in the ICU for patients with persistent vegetative state or coma, such as median nerve stimulation and transcranial laser, which are different technologies that have been used for many years in the ICU as a methodology to try to stimulate, using sort of the underlying bioelectric capabilities of our bodies to wake up these patients. So we are fully aware that it is important to have both sides of that particular puzzle solved. It's one thing to have tissue, but at the end of the day, we have to realize that, and as the guest mentioned, we are all technically electrical beings.
We sure are. I mean,
there's bioelectric currents flowing through our bodies.
And we're all memory, because exactly. Without that, who are we?
Exactly.
Right?
And that, you know, then once again, that feeds to back to the discussion we were having about the mind. What is the mind? We have put our bets into the concept that the mind is more than the goo inside the skull. The mind is the complex bioelectromagnetic fields that emanate from our system. And those fields emanate at the DNA level, they emanate at the cellular level, the organ level, the body segment level, and there's a lot of information processing going on there. And it just makes sense that in looking at the mind and memory that it is not just the stuff that sits there in the skull. There's very smart people that say not much happens inside the brain. It's not, it doesn't store a lot of stuff. It's just a very complex receiver and transceiver of information flow, just like the heart pumps blood and your lungs pump oxygen. And so, we are comfortable placing our bets that that is going to be the true outcome of what we're going to find in this study, that will be a recoverable element.
I'm sure you've got a lot of people interested in this study. Lots of people.
Yeah, from all angles. From families for taking care of loved ones that are in persistent vegetative states or coma, to those that have been diagnosed with the brain death criteria, to many different CNS groups, degenerative disorders. They see the potential of this, and you hear about it initially that, oh my God, they're working with dead people. It sounds a little freaky, but they have to realize this type of research has gone on. It's not glamorous, but the clues and the answers that we can get out of this, not just for human regeneration, but some of the answers for the human mind, as the caller mentioned, are inaccessible via other methods.
Call this the Lazarus Project, huh? Let's go to Lynn in Orange, California. Get you in real fast, Lynn. Go ahead.
Yes. What I'd like to know, if things aren't mysteriously disappearing from pharmaceutical hiding the success rate, then what happened to the Scripps LaJolla heart stem cell that went into its second stage in 2012, 2013 in the ARP magazine, I believe it was March, May issue, that there was the doctor basically made a statement, stunning success on the second stage. In the first stage, they were seeing the fact that within hours to days, remarkable results of healing of the heart through the stem cell therapy that they had done. But not only that, as the blood flowed out and went into the kidneys and the lungs and all the other aspects, down to sprained or broken legs, that there was amazing healing. And yet we're 3 years out of it and nothing, dead silent.
All right, hold that thought, Ira. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I was looking at the seating charts in Asheville, North Carolina, and in St. Louis, where we're going to have two live stage show events, and they are going fast. So get up to coasttocoastdam.com. June 18th is the live show in St. Louis. Come on out from all over the region. And then in August, I know we're way ahead of the game here, but it's a smaller theater, and those tickets are going fast, too. Everything's at coasttocoastdam.com, and I'd love to have you out there for that great series of events. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Ira Pastor is with us, of course. He heads up the company BioQuark. Ira, let's get back into the past call and what she was talking about, and let's bring Lynn back in for a quick review. Lynn, go ahead.
I'd like to know, how come we haven't heard anything in 3 years after it had such a remarkable success rate on the first part of the study and on the second part of the study, that within starting it within months, he was releasing to ARC magazines, making the statement that the therapy had gone again one more time remarkably and stunningly, and that it had gone even beyond the heart as the stem cells were pumped out of the heart and into the rest of the body. How come we haven't heard anything for over 3 years about it?
Where'd it go, Ira? Is the media not interested, or are they suppressing it? What's going on?
Well, I mean, it's an excellent point Lynn brings up, and it's what, you know, what we refer to in the industry and as your so-called valley of death. You have wonderful discoveries, and you would think that sort of the normal pathway in their development is very stepwise and linear. But the truth is, when you bring into all the factors that come into play in terms of competing industrial interests, funding, things that may not have intellectual property anymore, things where the regulatory model is confused, conflicting legislative initiatives, even religious implications, this stuff falls into this valley of death, as it's known. And it's a shame, it's a horrible situation, but we lose so many promising tools and technologies based on this perverse model that we sit in currently, with infighting between groups of researchers. It's not all fun and games when it comes to the promulgation of new scientific progress. It can become a very ugly, fragmented sort of evolutionary tree, and the most fruitful parts of that tree are not always the ones that make it through. And that's why we need alternative models in doing this in the future.
I had a friend who fell about 5-6 years ago, paralyzed from the neck down. Had stenosis in the first place, but this just pushed him over the edge. I have tried to get him convinced to do stem cell therapy, and he just won't do it, Ira. He won't do it. He's afraid if something goes wrong, he'll never walk again. And I tell him, you're not walking now. Do it. But the things you're working on, I bet he'd be up and walking in 6 months.
Yeah, we've studied models of spinal cord injury ourselves. And yes, the answer to spinal cord injury is right in front of us. And when you can when you have species whose spinal cords you can just chop in half and they regrow back in perfect form and function, there are clues there. And we believe that the clues involve stem cells, but one of the big tricks of spinal cord injury is ultimately how you get things to connect the right way and get the scar tissue out of the way, because you don't want the nerves connecting with the scar tissue, that doesn't do anything good. So what we have been studying and where we think the breakthrough is going to come is how you not only provide new neurons, but you transdifferentiate the scar tissue away and turn the scar tissue also into conductive tissue that can ultimately lead to the reconnections and the proper reconnections too. I mean, you understand the spinal cord is a very complex place. You don't
sure
want nerves that are coming down that's supposed to go to the arm, going to the leg, and so forth. So, but nonetheless, nature has shown us how to get this done, and it's just a matter of now mimicking nature and doing it the right way.
What does the laser do in your work?
Transcranial laser technology has been used for many years in the ICU, and as far as sort of the whole bioelectric networks and stimulating impulses in the central nervous system as a way to ultimately wake up some of these persistent vegetative state patients and coma patients. We are going to be looking at them sort of as adjuvant technologies to the underlying biologic tools we are using as ultimately ways to sort of spark some bioelectric activity in the neuronal tissue as we generate it. So we think it's a key tool, one that exists already, and that is going to be part of a combinatorial approach to solving this problem.
Let's go to Nebraska. Kenneth is with us. Hey, Kenneth, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just curious if the guest has done any studies with using medicinal mushrooms. There's been several studies done, and I was just curious if he's...
All right, we'll find out. And yesterday there was a study just released on the magic mushrooms that are saving people from depression, Ira. But I don't know if you don't get into the herbal supplement remedies, do you?
Well, I was in that business actually prior to this, so I can definitely speak to it from both directions. So one, yes, I mean, any species like a mushroom that has been around for a billion years or so on this planet knows how to take care of itself. And that's why plants and fungi and all these lower organisms, they've been through a lot worse than we have as humans in terms of ice ages and everything that has happened on this planet. They know how to survive, and they have a fascinating realm of chemistry that humans can ultimately learn from and apply. So we're all for, I am all for these tools. And you have to keep in mind, too, that something like 85% of all drugs on the market nowadays came from originally bacteria, fungi, and plants, so still extremely important. The study you point to is also very exciting, and then gets into the realm of visionary or hallucinogenic substances and taking a relook at things like magic mushrooms, like substances like ibogaine, and even LSD is coming back on the scene now, and, you know, which were once recreational and sort of, you know, scheduled substances, and still scheduled substances by DEA, but now studies are happening all over the United States on how these substances, now that we understand a little more about them in the 21st century, how they can be used to deal with issues like post-traumatic stress disorder, like depression. Even there was a study on magic mushrooms in California recently on a fear of death study on how you can sort of ease the transition of someone who's terminally ill using these substances. So I think it's a wonderful area and one that doesn't get as much research attention and funding as it should.
Okay, back to the calls we go. We don't have that much time left. Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Ira. Hi. I have a fantastic, immense, philosophical and scientific question that I want to ask from a scientific point of view about death, about the nature of death, and what happens, or if anything happens, after we die from a scientific point of view. I'm an atheist, a rational atheist, so I don't agree with the word soul. I would say mind is the answer, or consciousness, same thing, mind or consciousness, and I would not agree with heaven or hell in a religious or spiritual sense. But I do think personally it is possible that the mind or the consciousness of a person might be able to exist in what I would call maybe an energy dimension or an energy universe once the brain and the body fully dies. My question to you specifically is, do you think it's possible that your studies, your experiments in the near future, in a few years, may give us not only a theory of consciousness, understanding what consciousness is, because we don't know yet what consciousness is. Dr. Leonard Mlodinow, our physicist, said that on Coast a few years ago. But not only give us an understanding of what consciousness is, but understand if it's somehow possible that the mind, the consciousness, can exist once the body and the brain dies, even if we don't know exactly where the mind is, assuming where is a word to use, where, but where the mind may be. At least we may know, or would we know through your experiments, that somehow that the mind or consciousness might be able to exist once the brain and body fully die?
Well, let's say it's a wonderful question, and it's one that, as mentioned earlier, is probably as exciting as reversing death is. It is probably even more exciting underlying what this project is all about. If there's ever been a project that will answer that question or allow us to look through the curtain, as it will, this is it. Because if we do prove, that the person that comes back is the same, yet they were in a state of brain death, that mind, that memory, that consciousness, whatever you want to define it as, went somewhere. Whether that is extra-dimensional space-time, or whether that is in the electromagnetic fabric of the universe, wherever it may be, and we don't know the answer to that yet, and as the listener pointed out, it's been debated for hundreds of years, and if we did nothing else, we'd debate it for hundreds of years more. But these types of experiments will no doubt allow us to look through the curtain for the first time. And it is, as mentioned, it is an equally important and fascinating part to this type of research, because you can only ask the non-human species so much. But when you can ask a human what was there, and when they come back, you're opening a unique field of knowledge and truth.
Are the biologists and the medical doctors that are coming out of college, are they excited about this field?
I think so. I think we're seeing a lot of it, especially the ones that don't have sort of the traditional reductionist hat on, that, you know, it's fine to study neurons and microRNAs and certain chemicals inside neurons and what have you, but at the end of the day, there is a mind, there is a process of mind, of consciousness that is just not reducible in that context. And these are the types of programs that ultimately will elucidate for us some of those answers. So we think we're getting a lot of positive feedback from all fields, actually. It's been a lot more surprising than I thought about how supportive even people in the long-time folks that have hung around the neurointensive space for 30, 40 years, they come out of the woodwork and say, you know what, I've been doing this for the last 40 years, and I've been waiting for somebody to take this chance and somebody to do work like this. They would never, I was a young kid, I came out of medical school, blah, blah, blah. I could never do it. I didn't have the time or the resources, but it had to be done, and it's never been done, and thank you for doing it. So we're pretty pleased with that response from the neurointensive community.
Are those in India that you're working on this phase one trial excited about this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Dr. Bansal, whose group we've collaborated with in the past, and not just this, but some of our spinal cord injury work, is equally exciting. And I think no matter what geography you're looking at, we have people contacting us now from Brazil and South Africa and Thailand and all over the place. This is something that, people ask, why has this not been done before? Oh, there's a lot of reasons why it hasn't been done before. But at the end of the day, it's happening. And I think, this is just one small step. I think ultimately our next step is making this multi-centered and expanding it to multiple countries and getting many different neurointensivists actually looking at this area of research and saying, hey, it's a viable area of research, it's legitimate, and it should be explored with much more resources and larger patient populations.
Let's go to John in Commerce, California. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a two-part question.
Okay.
First one is, out of all the government NCI funding, why does only 4% go to childhood cancer research? And my second part question is, when having a baby, what are the benefits of saving the umbilical cord as far as stem cell research goes? And what kind of diseases does it cure?
All right. Interesting questions. I remember my parents had an old custom of saving the umbilical cord, and they all did it in the Middle East. It was really strange, but go ahead, Ira.
Yeah, I think the current focus with the umbilical cord research has been in a source of hematopoietic reconstitution, so a stem cell source that could reconstitute the blood system, if need be in the future, if a child needed chemotherapy or something, or some other disease that depleted that crucial natural supply, that here was a viable source of cellular material for that type of regeneration and reconstitution. I haven't really followed much in terms of cord blood as it relates to other more complex forms of regeneration, but nonetheless, they are multipotent cells that can technically differentiate into many different types of tissues and become lots of things if dealt with in the right way. So that's definitely something that we believe in, that everyone should be looking at as a definite health maintenance component of their life. I missed the funding question.
About cancer research.
Oh. Yeah, well, that's a whole other topic.
That's another show.
It's another show, but I can briefly touch on it, and that is we spend, in the war on cancer, and now there's a second war on cancer happening, we spend trillions, right? And the majority of that money goes towards one dominant theory of cancer, which has existed for decades now, and that's the somatic mutation theory of cancer, that cancer is nothing more than this set of mutation events that leads to uncontrollable malignancy, metastasis, and death. And despite it all that, and everything that we've ever created, we still have millions of new cases each year, and we have millions of deaths, and with only slight improvements in outcome. And what this is all pointing to, and I can get into this on the next show, is the fact that we are learning as a community now, slowly but surely, that the mutations themselves may not be as important as controlling the higher level architecture of the tissue. Because you have many situations in literature where it is not explained by the mutation theory of cancer. You can't explain spontaneous remissions, you can't explain foreign body tumor formation, and you can't explain the endless experiments that have been done that show how you can take a cancer cell and put it in a different environment and it becomes normal. Or the reverse. And so when you look at all these factors, yet we continue to focus on the kill-centric approach, targeting these mutations, yet we're getting hardly anywhere, you realize that something's wrong and that cancer is something that we can throw trillions of dollars more at, and if we don't look beyond the accepted model, we're not going to get anywhere.
No, not at all. Ira, I want to thank you for being on the program, and I hope you continue getting the kind of exposure you need to get this out.
I really appreciate the time, George. It was fascinating, and been a big fan of the show for years. So thank you so much.
Thank you. This is a great subject matter. They're doing a study. They're looking for recruiting 20 patients who have no brain function, and they want to treat them with stem cells and lasers and hopefully regenerate that brain function and basically bring them back to life. That is amazing. Well, we're going to come back in a moment and have open lines on Coast to Coast AM, including, of course, something I want you to think about. The most demonic person you ever ran into, what happened to you? Share those stories with us next.